Welcome to Happily Ever After is just the beginning. Keeping your relationship not just together, but happy, and we mean truly happy, is part art and part science. You've come to the right place. Here's your host, Leslie Dorries.
One of the first questions I ask the couples who come to me for help with their marriages is, why did you get married? The usual answer is that they were in love, but lots of people who fall in love don't get married. So there must be something more behind the decision to take the step into formally joining their lives together with one another. Now, historically, marriage was about economics and, somewhat relatedly, paternity. In some places, this may still be the case, but it isn't true any longer in Western societies. And as a result of changes, divorce is an option for many, and choosing not to marry in the first place is gaining traction in many places. So here's the big question. Is marriage dead? So I'm exploring this question today with my colleague, licensed clinical psychologist and author, Dr. Kelly Flanagan. And Kelly, welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Yeah, thank you for having me back, Leslie. It's good to be here.
And so, you know, like I said, like I told you before we started the show, you know, I've been reading your blog for years, and one of your recent posts really caught my attention, and it's entitled, Dear Marriage, Humanity Wants a Divorce from You. And I love the title. It was like, okay, I got to read this. And you start this post by mentioning some really troubling statistics out of Japan, and kind of how that country is acting as you say, a canary in the coal mine regarding marriage. So can you explain what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you alluded in your introduction to the show, the views of marriage, expectations of marriage have changed dramatically over time. You go back millennia and marriage is mostly a method of consolidating power or consolidating wealth or promoting, like as you said, paternity. But that has shifted, and that shifted to what some might refer to as like a love match approach to marriage, right? We're gonna try to find somebody that matches our first of all, we fall in love with them, and then matches our kind of desire for life and so on. It's shifted essentially from a more kind of collective motivation and agenda for marriage to a more personal one. So anyhow, a shift like that, for instance, when you look back, probably happened over the course of about 200, 250 years, that shift from a more collectively motivated marriage arrangement to these more personally motivated desires.
Back in the day, almost all marriages were arranged marriages, not love matches, and now everybody's in search of their soulmate.
Right, exactly. And even when you know, it was sort of up to the person to choose a partner, that choice was very much made in the context of who is my family, who is their family, how does this serve our families in general, right? Mm-hmm. So the shift to this very personal, individualized kind of preference for marriage, it happened over the course of 300 years. So you look at some statistics in Japan. I'm going to tell you a couple of them here. So in Japan, the percentage of men planning to marry has dropped from 67% to 39%.
Wow.
And the number of women, yeah, that's a huge drop. And the number of women planning to marry has dropped from 82% to 59%. And the interesting thing here is, I mean, those are huge drops, but again, you know, our perspectives and our view of marriage changes. The question is, over what period of time has this change happened? Are we talking over the last 100 years? Is it over the course of several generations, as these things sometimes happen? And the answer is no. That drop has happened in just 3 years.
Yes, that was the stunning when I read that. I went, oh, my gosh, 3 years.
Yeah. It's astounding. It's unprecedented. We're not going to really fully understand it for a while, but based upon the trends you're starting to see in other countries as well, you know, I refer to it as the canary in the coal mine, suggesting that, that maybe we're heading in this direction, probably not just in Japan, but humanity in general seems to be heading in this very quick shift in the way that we value marriage.
Well, I mean, and that's interesting because I know sometimes when I talk about marriage, and a lot of times when I talk about marriage, I'm not necessarily talking about the legal, yes, we've gone down to the courthouse and got married, but you know, when I talk about how to make a long-term relationship work, it's a committed relationship, and marriage is a particular kind. But marriage actually does provide some protections, at least specifically in the United States, because I know people will throw up to me, well, people in Europe don't get married, you know, legally married, but I think they've got different social structures to help protect the family, which is another important reason people decide that they're going to get married.
Right. And I think it's true that in the United States that that marriage is still considered to be more of a given than in most places in the world. And we might see some of the influences translate to the United States a little bit more slowly than elsewhere in the world. But I think that, so the question here, you know, is, you know, it's not our attitudes changing at an unprecedented rate. It's why? What's going on? And whether or not that those attitudes change as quickly in the United States or maybe at a more delayed pace, what's going on? And I don't think, you know, when you look at these kinds of demographic changes, usually you don't really get the scientific data on it for about 10 years. You know, like it takes time to run the studies and have them peer reviewed and to publish them and to disseminate the results. And so it's probably going to take a while for us to understand what's going on in Japan, what's going on elsewhere in the world where we see this relationship to marriage changing. So what we've got basically is educated guesses at this point. And so with this letter to marriage that I wrote, I wanted to sort of provide my educated guess based upon my professional experience in working with couples and my personal experience as a, you know, as a married person, and to sort of make a guess at what I think is happening and how these, this sort of change can be explained.
Well, and I love that you bring that up because one of the things that you say is that, you know, one of your proposals is that marriage has failed to give people what they want. So in what way? What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we go back to this idea that the driving motivation for marriage has shifted from things like power and possessions and patriarchy, and it's shifted to a much more individualistic kind of personal agenda for marriage, and I'm actually okay with that. I'm on board with that. I'm not hugely invested in seeing people use the institution to, you know, consolidate wealth and power. I'm not a big fan of that. But the question is, which particular personal motivations are driving it? You know, what exactly are we saying that we want from marriage as people? And I think, so in the letter, I sort of wanted to articulate what I see as some of the ways we misplace our personal motivations for getting into a marriage.
Okay.
And what are those? Well, okay. So, you know, as I say in the letter, one of the things that, you know, one of the, I guess, common things that you'll hear people say is, well, you know, that's what you do when you grow up. To be an adult, you have to get married. It's a sign of maturity, right?
Mm-hmm. I wish that were true. I wish that, like, marriage, that suddenly when you get married that somebody taps you on the head and says, okay, you're mature now.
I know, exactly. Well, and can you imagine how disappointing it is to discover that?
There's no magic to that.
Yeah, and I remember that. It's so silly when I look back on it now, but I remember those first times saying to people, yeah, so my fiance and I are going to, and just feeling like I could stand a little taller, you know, that somehow I had entered into this adulthood experience. And we have fewer and fewer rites of passage in our lives now.
Well, that's true.
I think we do as people look for what are the rites of passage, and so marriage has been seen as a rite of passage for people, but there really is nothing about getting married itself that does anything to transform us into a state of greater maturity or adulthood. And so it becomes very disappointing in that sense, right? And I think also that people look to marriage, the assumption is going to be that, well, I'll get married, and it will create sort of a sense of stability in my life, a sense of security. In fact,
which it can, exactly.
Data shows, right, that people who are married tend to live longer, tend to be healthier. So this is true. But when you look back, actually, at the peak, sort of the peak of the marriage boom in post-World War II America, what you saw was you saw a generation of people who had come through, you know, World War I, they'd come through the Great Depression, they'd come through World War II, and they were desperate to create some sense of stability in their lives. And so you saw that marriage became one way of doing this, create stability, move to the suburbs, get married, and again, the expectation that simply engaging in the act of marriage would somehow create that sense of stability, but we all know that things don't suddenly settle down when you get married.
No.
It actually kind of stirs
things up for a little while, which I think comes as a big surprise to most people.
Absolutely, it stirs things up. And I think how couples handle that initial stir-up is really important, too. I think sometimes some really unhealthy patterns can get established in that initial, in those early newlywed years that translate into trouble for the marriage. But you discover relatively quickly that marriage is hard work. Marriage is, you know, you thought, well, I'll get married and this will mean I never have to worry about being alone again. And then in all sorts of little ways, you feel those little micro abandonments happening on a day-to-day basis. And you go, wait a second, I got married. We're living together now.
This wasn't supposed to happen. Yeah.
This wasn't supposed to happen. I wasn't supposed to feel alone anymore. And now I still feel alone, and that feels incredibly insecure. And so marriage disappoints, I think, in that way, too. And, you know, I think that one of the things I talk about in my book, Lovable, is that, you know, when we get married, I don't think we're actually getting married because we've discovered somebody who makes us feel loved. I think we get married because we've discovered somebody who, for just a little while, has made us feel lovable. I think it's important that we've discovered somebody who makes us feel worthwhile, worthy, someone who makes us feel like we belong. And one of the ways that I'll help distinguish for couples this idea is, and it sounds sort of provocative, but I think it's better to feel unloved and lovable than to feel loved and unlovable. And the reason for that is that if we feel unlovable and we're loved, we have a hard time receiving that. Receiving that love from another. But if we feel as though we are lovable and at the moment we don't feel terribly loved, we can sort of trust kind of at the core of us that love will eventually come. I'll find it. I'm lovable. I'm worthy of love. And so I think for a little while, we find somebody who makes us feel lovable, worthy. And I think that we expect that experience to last, but I think the reality is that feeling lovable is something that we have to be able to trust in ourselves. No one can do that for us over time. So eventually things start to happen, you know, disappointments happen, words are traded, and all of a sudden you're feeling less lovable again. You're right back to where you started, and now you're very disappointed in the marriage again.
Well, and I think that's, when you're talking about this, it brings up this wonderful thing that if I just find my soulmate, you know, this one magical person who's going to make all the pain in my life go away, then everything will be great, except one, there is no such thing, and two, boy, does that put a whole lot of responsibility onto somebody else, because...
Well, yes.
You know, because there's no way, I mean, and I say this all the time to people, if my husband does something and I, you know, my feelings are hurt or I'm feeling, you know, disappointed or in something, then, you know, I know my husband's a good guy. So the first place I go is that, oh, he doesn't know that I'm having this reaction. He doesn't know that I'm struggling with this. because I know he wouldn't do this on, you know, this isn't something he's doing on purpose. But I think a lot of people think, because it's the mind-reading school of marriage or love, that if they loved me, they would just know what hurts me, what makes me happy, and I should never have to tell them. And then, of course, we're completely disappointed because, you know, they're stumbling around and bump into us in the dark and step on our feet.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think what you're getting at is that sometimes the love match approach to marriage has a very sort of codependent quality about it. You know, you should be able to read my mind. I should be able to read yours. We should feel like sort of perfectly united all the time, and never have to deal with the complexities of being two very different people. I think when those disappointments start to happen, when the other person isn't reading our mind well enough, then that's where you start to see blame, right? I blame you for not understanding me enough. I blame you for me now feeling insecure again.
Right.
When the reality is,
stop this. I would be fine and our marriage would be great.
Yes, and that's one of the things I'll often do with couples is we'll do some work to really articulate that the insecurities you feel in your marriage, the frustrations, they existed way before you met this person.
Yeah.
You were just hoping that they could sort of wave their magic wand and do away with them altogether, but it turns out they can't. And now you're going to have to go back to figuring out what to do with them yourself. And that just can be really disappointing.
Yes. This is Happily Ever After is just the beginning on WebTalkRadio.net. I'm Leslie Dorries, and I'm talking today with Dr. Kelly Flanagan, licensed clinical psychologist and author, about what's wrong with marriage and whether it has a future. So if you feel let down by marriage as an institution in general or by your marriage in particular, I invite you to take a moment and go to my website to get your copy of Three Secrets to a Kick-Ass Marriage. You can find it at my website, www.foundationscoachingnc.com. That's FOUNDATIONS, coaching, N as in Nancy, C as in Charlie.com. Or you can contact me directly at area code 919-924-0463 or through email at Leslie, L-E-S-L-I, at foundationscoachingnc.com to find out how you can make your marriage great right now. But I want to get back to this conversation about marriage as the institution and how it shifted and where it's going. And so, Kelly, why is blaming marriage the wrong way to look at this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a good question. You know, I think as our conversation has alluded to, you know, marriage is truly what we make it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've tried to do is we've tried to make it into something that will make us happy all the time. Something,
lots of life.
And so, you know, happily ever after, right? Just beginning.
Right.
And, right, something that will make us happy, something that will make us feel finally not alone. And the reality is that happiness, it's a human experience that comes and goes, even in the best of situations. And feelings of loneliness are a human experience that come and go, even in the best of situations. And so we've tried to make marriage into this thing that will somehow cement us in this state of happiness and unloneliness. And so the question isn't, you know, what's wrong with marriage? The question is, what's wrong with what we've tried to make marriage into? And instead now we have an opportunity to make it into something that makes us more loving people, people who, you know, who are more forgiving, people who are more patient, people who are more tender, people who are more brave, people who are more compassionate. Those are the opportunities that we have in marriage. But if we stay focused on wanting marriage to make us happy, make us feel only, you know, not alone anymore, then marriage is a problem. So I don't think we need to blame marriage. I think we can kind of look in the mirror and say, what were my motivations? And how are they not serving me well in terms of being in a true, enduring, committed relationship with somebody?
Well, and it sounds like, and I've run across this a little bit, is almost like, okay, I'm married, I now don't have to put in any effort. And, you know, I had a friend who he was thinking about getting married for the third time, and he comes to me and he asks me if I think he should, which I find it interesting. You shouldn't be asking an outside person whether or not you should get married, but that's a whole other question. And I said to him, I said, only if you still think there's a difference between marriage and courtship behavior, with marriage behavior coming out on the short end of the stick. Because, you know, we all put this effort into, you know, meeting somebody and starting the relationship. And then it's like, oh, yeah, we're married. I don't have, you know, it's like, all right, they're here. I don't have to do anything anymore.
Right.
Let me just sit on the couch in my sweats.
Well, and there's a lot of, you know, because there's a lot of speculation that, you know, so for instance, why people who are married in a particular religious context where marriage is, where divorce is considered to be more taboo, why do those marriages end in divorce just as frequently as couples who are married in more secular marriages? And one of the ideas is that, well, when you enter into a marriage in a context where divorce is taboo, you're more likely to assume, well, I don't have to do anything now. We're good to be, you know, they're not going to leave me, right?
They can't leave me.
They can't leave me, and so the work is done, right? So I think that idea that it's not going to require work is a particularly sort of damaging way to think about marriage. I have a hard time talking about what marriage could really be for without talking about the ego.
Okay.
And I know, right? It's a big topic, but let me try to unpack that in a second here. In my understanding, people come into the world with a true self. That true self is absolutely worthy of love and belonging. But somewhere along the way, all of us encounter the message that it isn't. That it isn't good enough. That it isn't worthy of love and belonging. And this is an experience that many people call shame. And at that moment where we encounter shame, we begin to build a false self. We say, well, my true self isn't good enough to earn love and belonging, so I'm going to build a false self. And that false self is in charge of going out and meeting the world and earning me the love and belonging that I've been desiring all along. And the other word for this false self is our ego. It's our way of sort of keeping our true self hidden so we can't be rejected anymore.
Right. It keeps me safe.
Mm-hmm. Keeps me safe. It's the part of me that defends me, so it's the most aggressive parts of me. It's the perfect facade that I put on so that, you know, there is almost no one who has ever gone on a first date who wasn't leading with their ego, with their false self, right?
Of course,
Kelly,
I'm just trying to make a good first impression.
Yes, exactly. And then everyone's confused when later you can't keep up that facade forever. And no one can, because it requires an enormous amount of energy to do that.
Uh-huh.
But the way this false self or this ego backfires is that my true self is tucked away and hidden and protected, right? So it actually, in the long run, even though I thought I was building this false self to go out and help me kind of earn love and belonging, it actually keeps me very, very lonely, because my true self is never actually able to show up, be authentic, make connections, be vulnerable. I never find actually true love and belonging. And what's interesting about the ego is that everywhere else in the world, the ego helps you be successful. Everywhere else, but
yes,
in marriage,
that is absolutely true.
Right, in business and careers, in sports and athletics, having a competitive ego leads to success. But in marriage, if you're operating from your ego, it guarantees failure. I see this oftentimes, and it's very confusing for people who are very successful in business and in career, and they try to run their marriage or their family like they run their business or career, and it's a total disaster.
It doesn't work very well.
It doesn't work because married life and family life requires the letting go of the false self. It requires the letting go of the ego and the return to the true self if it's going to be successful. And so I actually tell people, people say, well, you shouldn't expect people to change in marriage. I say, I actually expect marriage to change everyone, change them back into who they were originally, to do away with the false self, do away with the ego, and create a place where their true self can come out and shine. And so when I say marriage transforms us, I'm saying marriage transforms us back into who we were always intended to be.
Wow, that's really powerful and, oh, by the way, terrifying.
And, by the way, terrifying, yes. Well, and that's exactly because you're exactly right, because that means in our marriages, it's the place where for the first time with another person, for the first time in years and years, we uh-huh. begin to show up for real again and take risks to say, when I show up, in the past when I showed up for real, people gave me the message that I wasn't good enough. And now I'm going to show up for real, and I'm gonna take that brave step to see if you will invite me out of hiding, essentially. And I'm going to try to do the same for you. And that's for the rest of our lives. That's what we're going to try to do on a daily basis, is invite each other out of hiding.
Well, no wonder the Japanese aren't doing this anymore.
Well, and I think it starts to tie into perhaps why it's changing so fast, because in a world where, you know, we know this is true in the United States.
Uh-huh.
For instance, the kids are getting driver's license at a radically reduced rate than they used to. They're waiting until 18 or 19.
Uh-huh.
The rate of all sorts of social behaviors is just dropping dramatically, because what kids want is they want a phone and they want a bedroom to themselves to interact with their friends on the phone. And it is really easy to hide behind a false self in your bedroom with a phone.
Take a look at Facebook and Twitter and all Instagram and what gets posted, and it's like, I mean, isn't it also the rates of depression and anxiety in kids are going way up because everybody's putting this false picture of themselves out into the universe?
Well, you know what's interesting about that is that in the same years that those rates of plans to marry had dropped in Japan, the rates of depression and anxiety in youth ages 12 to 17 have skyrocketed. Like,
oh,
again,
wow.
In ways that you should see that over the course of generations, but it's happened in 5 years. I think what's happening is a normalizing of hiding behind the false self and hiding behind the ego.
Uh-huh.
And, I guess in a sense, there's a sort of wisdom in these young people in Japan, right? If they're saying, this is how I want to live. I want to live hidden behind my ego and hidden behind my false self. I better not get married. I think that's true, because I think if that's where you want to stay, the marriage is probably not going to be terribly successful.
That's true. So does it make a difference?
Yeah.
Does it make a difference if marriage as an institution survives?
I think it makes all the difference. To be honest, a world in which human beings are not being challenged to let go of their egos is a terrifying world. A world where sort of the collective human ego strengthens, and it's more about hiding and more about being aggressive and more about competing and more about dominating and more about perfecting, that's a pretty unpleasant world to live in. And,
yeah, the way you describe it doesn't sound very nice to me.
No, I don't. People who are operating entirely from their false self or ego, those are hard people to be around. I don't think we all want to become that person. And to think that marriage is the one place that we're going to be invited to put down that false self and put down that ego and live from our true self, which is inherently loving and tender and compassionate and forgiving and caring, I think it absolutely matters that marriage survives. I'd probably say something a little more provocative, which is I'd be okay with marriage dying and resurrecting it as something better, resurrecting it as something that is specifically designed to help us let go of our false self and step back into our true self.
So is that what you meant in the article about the question that you ask is, what does marriage want from me? Is this whole idea of letting go of the false self? And not just, and the thing about marriage isn't just that I'm letting go of my false self, because that's important,
right?
But that I accept my partner letting go of their false self.
Yes, absolutely.
And learning to, because everybody talks about unconditional love, and I think this is what we're talking about, because I can't agree with you more. Well, because I tell my clients all the time, every person on the planet has the right, inherent right of worth.
Yes.
You don't have
absolutely.
To earn it. And, you know, there isn't anything,
right.
you know, if I collect 100 points, I'm worthy. I mean, you know.
exactly.
Whatever, you know, whatever it is. It's by definition, because we are here, we are worthy. And
yes.
sometimes I have a hard time, you know, looking at myself in the mirror and saying, yes, I'm worthy.
Yes.
But it's not an, you know, but it's really hard when our partner does something that we don't understand, or that we wouldn't do, or that we don't like. You know, we can still love them.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think more and more I'd love to see couples guided by that question of, is my partner acting from their false self or their true self? And if they're acting from their true self, and that's hard for me, I need to find a way to encourage it anyways. You know, I think of my own marriage. You know, my wife didn't marry a starving artist. she didn't marry an author, right?
Right.
Who is trying to spend more and more of his time doing that and less of his time doing things that could actually make him money.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, and I started to get emotional because she's loved me so well by encouraging me to do that. And you know, my wife has all sorts of good, healthy boundaries, and you know, we've had good conversations about the extent to which I can do that, and
uh-huh.
you know, all the complications of finances and all of that. So we work together on that, but she's encouraged me to embody that true self that she didn't even know was there when she married me. And you know,
you might not have even known it.
And the truth is I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, you know, several years ago, I was married to a tenured professor of psychology whose job was guaranteed and about as secure as it can be in the world. And then as she began to get more reconnected with her true self, she said, I've never really wanted to be a professor. I've always wanted to provide mental health services to underserved populations. Well, as you probably know, working with underserved populations is never a stable, stable job.
No.
I didn't know that I was going to be married to a woman who was going to do that. But when she said, that's who I am and that's what I want to do, we had to find a way to make that happen. And so yeah, I do think it's hard. It's hard to step out from behind the false self.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, as we become more who we truly are, there's plenty of inherent challenges to that as well. But I'm not sure marriage can be satisfying and that it can thrive without that kind of transformation happening.
Well, I really like that, and it goes along with one of my favorite quotes, which I really should have the person who wrote this burned in my memory, and I just don't. But the quote is, marriage is our last best chance to grow up. And I
That's
think
it.
That what you've described today just, you know, just highlights the whole meaning behind that quote.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of, you know, my own flavor that I bring to that, trying to get at that idea that our true self has been with us all along and we buried it away and we're trying to excavate it again, is that, you know, marriage is our last best chance of growing young again, in a sense, of reconnecting with that little one, that true self that has been with us all along, and living from that. And I think that's, to me, that's the beautiful paradox about growing up, is that it is also growing young again.
Yes, and that does not mean childish. It means
no.
childlike. So
childlike, exactly. Yes,
and
childlike in all the ways that children are. I mean, they have so much wisdom that we sort of pass over because we think we're the ones who've got, you know, we've grown up. And
uh-huh.
so, yeah, childlike in all those ways that we sometimes take for granted.
Absolutely. Well, Kelly, thank you so much. This has been such an interesting conversation. And please tell people where they can find your blog, find your book, find out,
yeah.
you know, more about this philosophy of, you know, letting go of the false self.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So my blog, my website is drkellyflanagan.com. It's drkellyflanagan.com. If you go there, you can actually, in the right sidebar, you can sign up to get my free ebook, The Marriage Manifesto, Turning Your World Upside Down. And you'll also get a free sample of my book, Lovable, which came out about a year ago. And let's see, I guess if you want to just not just get a sample of Lovable, but get a copy of it. You can get it wherever books are sold, but you can also go to lovablethebook.com. It's lovablethebook.com, and you can find out all about it and check it out there, and then follow links to pick it up wherever you like to buy books. And then, of course, you can find me at Dr. Kelly Flanagan on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or all those good places.
All those wonderful social media sites. And so
you got it.
The whole thing is that, as we've been talking about today, marriage, the institution, whatever you want to call it, in and of itself isn't necessarily the problem. Because even if it goes away, people are still going to pair off and likely to continue to have children. But what we'll be missing is the protections that marriage was designed to provide, this growth opportunity, all of these wonderful things about it. And, while some of its traditional restraints have thankfully fallen by the wayside, there is still value in the concept. And so maybe what we should be thinking about is what would it take to make it better as an institution, and what would it take to make it better for you personally? And, that's the question I try to explore on the show. And so hopefully you find value in it. And until next week, stay loving.